Okay, so, yes, the gain on the microphone actually works. So, it was one of those moments. Last time I couldn't get the mic to do much, and of course, at the end of class, I realized it mattered that if I turned the gain. So, always check the gain and always see if it's plugged in. That always helps, or the better. Let's see. We're going to do a little bit of a change since I'm actually in town on Thursday. You're going to hand your problem sets in here if you've got them. I understand that you may not have been in the habit of driving in your class or whatever. If you want to slip them under my door sometime today, that's fine too. But all I can promise is that at some point tomorrow I will collect them and hand them to a TA. And at that point, that's when they're too late. So, do you have any issues, concerns, anything okay?
Quick question. What does the phrase gravitational analog mean?
Gravitational analog. Similar to gravitation. So you can analyze, for example, gravitation is a force that is informed, very similar to that of electrostatics. And so you can, in many ways, take the theories that we're looking at now and do the same sorts of things with gravity. And you have a lot of similar effects. So for example, in a spherical Gaussian problem, you've already learned that the field at a certain radius only depends on the charge that is inside that radius. In the same way, the gravitational field at a point in a massive body is only dependent on the mass that's inside of that, and that has to do because they're both under square laws. So last time we started looking at electrostatic potential, and the example we picked was just a point of charge, and we have a test charge, little Q0, and I moved it from point A to B, and for simplicity, I just moved it along the radial line. And then we calculated the work done, which is the integral from this point to that point, of the force that I exert, if I ask how much work do I do, dotted into the little ds vector along the path length that we're doing along. And when we did that calculation, we found that, in fact, this is what we got. And it is a difference of this, it depends only on endpoints, which is actually a profound statement. And then we decided that the problem is this depends on the charge that we have here, and you really don't want things depending on the magnitude of the little test charge you're moving around. So we want to divide that out. So we did that and looked at the work per unit charge, which is now going to be this KQ, 1 over RB minus 1 over RA. So it depends on the endpoints. And this is, in this particular example, it depends on the endpoints. But because we had a dot product and the electric field, the force that I have to exert as I move this charge from here to here, it's actually being pushed by this charge out. So I'm actually having to exert a force in, but that's along the radial line. And in the work integral, we have a dot product. So it actually doesn't matter what this path takes. The dot product projects out only the piece along that line. And that basically is going to mean that it's path independent, which is an important statement about electrostatics. It's the same thing as true in gravity. That's why when you're up at the top of the slide and you drop the baby or the ball, it doesn't matter what happens, whether the slide is straight down or like this. It's only the endpoints that are important if it's a frictionless situation. Okay. If you add friction to the situation, then you have a different problem. Forces that have that characteristic we call conservative forces. All right, so this is a general. So if we have a charge and we move it from point one to point two, and then we define this work per unit charge like we had on the last page as the potential difference between points one and two. When I think about potential difference, I ask how much work does it take me to to move that charge from point A to point B. But that's going to be basically work I'm doing on the system, so the system does the negative of that. So if we look at the energy of the system, then the work per unit charge that I'm doing, which we've defined as potential difference, goes as minus the change in the energy of the system per unit charge. And you'll see this potential difference written lots of different ways as differences in potential or delta V or sometimes just a V, sometimes a V with subscripts. So you have to pull out your special decoder ring and think, okay, this is a potential problem, so V here is potential. And yeah, I don't know, you sort of have to look at the problem and try to make sense of it. Now the units are in... It's a work per unit charge, so potential is important because it's really giving us information about the energy in the system. And so the units are in joules per coulomb for MKS. And we call this unit the volt. Okay, after this guy Volta, who seems to have serious anger problems, and perhaps if this is your name, you might get anger problems. But at any rate, look way back then, so he's the guy who invented the voltaic pile. So basically, you take dissimilar metals and an electrolytic liquid, and you can get a potential difference between the metals. So that's where the volt comes from, or the name of the volt. Okay. Now, we've looked at potential differences. And I think when you think of electric potential, it's a good idea to keep the gravitational analog in your mind, which is the potential energy difference between two heights, for example. You can sort of think of it the same way. And just like with height differences or potential energy from gravitation, So what is really relevant if you jump out a window as to whether you need to ever worry about anything again, or whether you're going to break an ankle, or whether you're just worrying about whether you land on a bug or something. Right? What the difference is how high you are when you jump. And so what's really important in many problems, most mechanics problems, is really the difference in height. That's what's really important. Once in a while, you worry about absolute height, but generally are you having to extend a lot of gas to drive up the mountain? You're going from a low point to a high point. That's what's important. It doesn't actually matter whether the mountain starts at sea level or if it starts a mile high. Okay, it's the difference that's really important. Nevertheless, it is useful to have an absolute measure of height, which on Earth we define as from sea level. And so the same thing is true in electromagnetism. Most of the time, it's really important to look at the differences in potential, because that basically tells you how the energy of the system changes as charge moves from one point to another. However, it is also sometimes really nice to pin an absolute potential somewhere, some sort of say, okay, we're going to look at differences, but they're all differences with respect to this, which we're going to define to have a certain energy or a certain potential. Okay, and that could be arbitrary. And if you get into designing electric circuits or worry about things in the real world, in fact, you might very much take the case of whatever it is you're working on and define it to a certain potential, and everything else is sort of done with respect to that. And you define it by literally setting the power supply that's hooked to it to a certain value. I mean, that's a way to do it. So what I'd like to do is to think for a moment, if we have a charge Q with our electric field lines coming out, and we move from point A into point B, we've seen that the work per unit charge, or the potential between points A and B, is equal to K times Q times 1 over R sub B minus 1 over R sub A. So in this problem, it's useful to say that at infinity, infinitely far away from the simple charge, we'll define the potential to be zero. And it fits this form very well because if you look at what happens when RA goes to infinity, this becomes zero. So if we make that definition of the potential, the absolute potential is zero at infinity, then we can talk about something which is the potential of a point charge, which is just going to be K times Q over R, the potential of the point charge at point R. This fits many, many problems that you look at. Very often in a problem, it makes a lot of sense to define the zero potential of infinity. And when you do that, then this form is something you always want to keep in mind. In fact, it happens so often that many students forget that there's more to it. And they think of potential always in this form, but it only follows from this particular definition of where you put the potential, right? And so there's always a couple of little gotchas that will come up during the semester where in the problem they say, we will define the potential of zero at this point as opposed to being at infinity. And remember what's important are potential differences. So at that point, you then have to actually calculate how much work it takes to move the charge from here to here and then calculate the potential differences. So you have to be a little bit careful with this, but this is actually important enough to deserve a red lining because you will use it very often. Okay. Now, one thing that's really nice about potential, which is extremely powerful, and that is that potential doesn't have a direction. It's a scalar. So calculations that involve potential should be, in general, much simpler than calculations of things involving electric fields, for example. So that's also pretty important, and you'll understand why as we move on. So that is the potential of a point charge. So if we now look at a system of discrete charges and we define the potential to be zero at infinity, then we can look at, it makes sense to ask what is the potential of a system of charges. So if we have a Q1 and a Q2 and some Qn discrete charges, and we ask, well, here's a point P out in space, we can ask, what is the potential at point P? And let's say Q1 is basically defined in terms of its position to be at a vector R1 away from point P. Q2 is vector R2 away from point P. Q sub n is a vector R sub n away from point P. The potential is just a scalar. We don't care that these are all coming from different directions. So we can just sum up the potential due to each of the discrete charges. So the potential at point P is going to be equal to the sum from I equal 1 to n for the total charges, the potential due to each charge. Now remember, each of these charges, they're point charges, so you have KQ over R, Q can be positive or negative. So it may be that they're canceling each other out, or maybe not. At any rate, so if we look at the individual charges, this is going to be the sum from I equal 1 to N of K times Q sub I over R sub I, where that R sub I is not a vector. Right? That's a blessing. It's just a distance. Yes.
see the expression V equals negative V times Y. And I'm like assuming that Y is just the displacement of the base down, but we can take the sign convention, so what the sign conventions are.
We'll get there. Yeah, that's where I want to relate potential to electric field, so I'm not there yet. All right, so again, this is a scalar sum, which makes it easy compared to a vector thing. And the next step is to look at a continuous charge distribution, so you can imagine that we have some potato of charge out here, and we ask the same question about if we have some point P in space outside of this charge or inside of the charge, it doesn't really matter. What is the potential at point P? The way to do this is, which I hope by now is becoming second nature to you, the way to do this is to take a little differential charge, right? This charge could be doing anything in that distribution. And if you consider a small enough little chunk of it, you can think of it as a constant little charge or that little dq, okay? And so that's what we're going to do. And the reason we do that is because if we think of a little piece of point charge that has no complexity in changing within it, I know how to calculate the potential at any radius from that. So I know what to do with that little dq. So here's a little dq. And it is going to be at a vector r from point P. And then we can write down the potential at point P due to dq, which in fact I'm going to call dv sub P, because since I'm dealing with a differential, I don't want to think of it as a potential. I want to think of it as a little differential potential, a little tiny potential. And I know now what to do with that because I know how to deal with point charges. It goes as K times Q, but Q is this little dq. So K dq over the distance r. So that's not a vector, it's a distance. And now this can be arbitrarily complex. The fact that I'm dealing with a scalar and a potential doesn't necessarily mean it's easy to make this calculation, but in general, all I have to do now to calculate the total potential at this point P is to sum up all the contribution to the potential from all of the little dq's. R is changing as I do that, and it depends on the geometry here and how the charge is distributed. But it also means we're just integrating over it. So the potential at point P is equal to the integral over the volume of the charge distribution, K times dq over r, and typically you're given the volume, you're given dq in terms of a charge distribution. So typically this is some sort of rho dv so that you can do the integral over the volume. And then what volume are you talking about? Well, that's the problem, right? It's a sphere, it's a cylinder, it's a whatever it is, and you have to deal with it. So again, remember when we were doing a very similar thing with the electric field? The electric field goes as K dq over r squared, and it has an r hat. First of all, we have the r squared dependence, which can complicate things. When you get squares and denominators, math becomes nastier usually. And we had an r hat over here because you have to worry about the direction. The direction of the electric field from all the little dq's is different. So in the electric field calculation, this is very hard. If we just want to calculate potential, life is sort of easy because we only deal with this one power bar. We have no directional dependence. So generally speaking, it is a lot easier to calculate potential than it is electric field. I can calculate potential, but in the end, why do I care? And the reason that you care is that there's a relationship between the potential and the electric field. And it is often much simpler to calculate the potential for a problem because dealing with the energy and the fact that you have no vector piece to it, and then using that to then calculate the electric field. So that's really the big advantage of the potential. So let's imagine that we have an electric field, and for simplicity we'll just have a uniform electric field going in the x direction. So I'll say it's e in the x, and x is going that way. And let's say that we have a charge little q0, and we move it from, say, x equal a to x equal b. Okay. And so the work the system does So the work that the system does is basically the force that the electric field is exerting on little q0 as it goes from A to B. So basically we're just taking q0, putting it in the electric field, and letting it go from A to B. So my fingers are not involved in this. I didn't do it. So the work that the system does is the integral of f dot dx, and f is just q times e. q0 times e in the x dx. Okay? That's the work the system does. So you can think of this in terms of, if I don't bother integrating it, you can imagine that the differential change in the energy of the system is q times ex times the differential change in x. Okay, that's a way to do it. And now if we want to look at the change in potential, that's the work the system does. Remember, we define potential as the work that I do as I move the charge from one point to another. So you get a sine flip from that. And then potential is work per unit charge, so we take out the little q0. So this is equal to minus e in the x dx. Or the electric field component in the x direction is equal to the change in the potential in that direction. Okay, with this little example. And because we have this dot product in here, it turns out that we don't have to have it so constrained to be always along the x. There's a general statement that the electric field in some arbitrary direction, the component of the electric field in a given direction, is equal to the negative of the derivative of the potential, or the change in the potential in that direction. So for direction S, here S is just some arbitrary axis. It could be X, Y, Z, whatever it is.
Is
du
this potential energy?
Du here is, change in potential. That's the change in the potential energy of the system. It's the work the system is doing.
And that's not negative?
It just is what it is. Its absolute value might be negative, since it's doing work on the charge, I guess. But I don't. That doesn't mean I suck it in. I mean, I'm just calling. This is just the amount of what the system is doing, whatever it is. I could, for example, have the field going the other way and still have the charge moving this way, and then the amount of work the system does is going to be positive in terms of absolute sign, but I would still write this in the same way. Is that BS? I'm just talking about the moment. Because if I do that, the field's going the other way, then, well, the force that the field is exerting on Q0 is still going to be a long BF. So I think that's just it's just an absolute number if you were calculating a real problem. In one case, it'd be positive, in one case, it'd be negative.
Right. But I mean, you're saying that if work is positive, then the potential energy would be negative, probably, just by the...
I mean, you have to be over careful. Potential energy of what? Potential energy stored in the system, potential energy of the particle.
Of the particle.
So if the system is doing positive work on the particle, then the particle's potential energy should be less, I think. Or this is equivalent to taking an object and letting gravity pull it down. So it's energy, the energy of the object is reduced.
So when that call for a negative sign in front of the U, or on the second line equation, U equals Q.
I try to be careful explaining it in the sort of way I think about it, but I'd lie to you if I didn't tell you that every time I teach this, I get tweaked without that minus sign and I have to go and think about it. How do I think about it? So the truth is, if I sit here and try to say it a bunch of different ways, we're just going to get all confused because it always confuses me too a bit. So let me try saying it again the way that I think about it. And, you have to sort of... I actually, yesterday, picked up two or three books to remind myself of this stupid minus sign, because it always bothers me. So, so the way I think about it is I'm looking at the work that the system does as the charge moves from A to B. So the force is exerted in the same direction as it's moving. So the net dot product here is positive. The force is Q times E. So this is all positive. And this I'm defining as the work that the system does. And I'm going to say, in this case I'm looking at the integral, but if I want to look at the differential piece, then work system does, I'm just defining the change in the energy of the system, dU. And that's going to be this piece without the integral, and so it's Q to dx. So that's why sort of by construction, this has just positive signs that I'm saying. And now what I'll say is that since I'm defining potential as the work that I would do on the charge, moving it from point to the other point, then that's basically got to be the opposite sign from the work that the system is doing, whereas the work done on me at best. And so that's where I think of the minus sign coming in.
Selectively, as I'm finding. There. So I don't know if that helps. There was a handle.
Yeah, what are we defining as the system in this case? Is it like the point charge, or is it the field, or is it everything?
Thank you, yeah. So I was being a little loose there. I would mean the field in this case.
Okay. Yeah. Or if the system does, I guess what I really mean is the field. When I say system, it's sort of more all-inclusive. It's whatever's creating the field. You can sort of think of the net. Really what I mean is sort of the work that that field is doing. I don't care how it got there. So. Okay, so this is a very general result. And it's going to be true in any direction. So if we want to go to three dimensions, then things get a little bit more complicated. In three dimensions, for example, the potential can be a function of x, y, and Z simultaneously, right? That's what you mean by a three-dimensional problem. And now you have a bit of a problem because it's a multivariable problem. So you can't just take the derivative of the potential in the x direction straight up, right? Because it's a multivariable problem. So how many of you are comfortable with partial derivatives? Okay. So in principle, based on what I said in the last page, you would say the E in the X is equal to minus the derivative of V in the X. E in the Y is equal to minus the derivative of V in the Y. And E in the Z is equal to minus the derivative of V in the Z. But you can't really do that because it's a multivariable problem. So you can't just take the derivative with respect to a single variable. So we have a way around that, which we call the partial derivative. And the way to think about a partial derivative is think of it just like a normal derivative. Well, mechanically, it's a normal derivative where you take the other variables, the ones where you're not taking the derivative of them, as constant. All right, and I really like partial derivatives. And the reason I really like partial derivatives is because this would be how you'd write the derivative of the potential with respect to x. And for a partial derivative, you do this. And it looks way cooler. I've always loved partial derivatives just for that. And so you do this where you hold other variables constant. So mechanically, it's really quite easy. What's happening conceptually is you're saying that wherever you are in your x, y, z space or whatever, you're simply looking at the slope at that point in space in that direction. And that's what the partial derivative sort of gives you. You can't just, because you have multiple variables, that slope may be changing as a function of y and z, even if you're just looking at the x, because you have a dependence on all three variables. So you have to be, so just think of the partial derivative in a given, with respect to a given variable, as the slope of the function at that point in XYZ space in that direction. Okay? So, yeah. All right, so mechanically, it's pretty straightforward. Let's say that we have some potential function XY, this function of X, Y, and Z, which we'll just say is 2X squared Y, Z cubed, okay? The partial derivative with respect to x is going to be the derivative with respect to x, which is going to be 2 times x times 2. And now you think of these as constants. So it's going to be 2 times x times 2yz cubed. Yeah, 2 times x times 2. So that's going to be 4xyz cubed. The partial derivative of v with respect to y is going to be 2x squared z cubed. So you just treat the x and the z as constants and take the derivative with respect to y. And the partial derivative with respect to z is equal to 6x squared yz squared. Yeah. All right, so mechanically it's not so bad to do. So why am I bothering you with all this? Well, what we want to do is, in a full three-dimensional problem, what you'd really like to do is to basically look at the slope of the direction of greatest rate of change for a potential, and that will give you the direction of the electric field. So what we'd like to do is to somehow combine, if we have the potential, so let us suppose that we have V which is a function of x, y, and z. And the electric field we know to be the electric field component in the x direction times I hat plus the electric field component in the y direction times j hat plus the electric field in the z direction times k hat. You guys dig the I, j, k? You've seen that before? Little unit vectors, okay. So if we don't worry about the whole partial derivative thing for a moment, then we would say that this is minus the potential in the x, this is minus the potential in the y, and this is minus the potential in the z. But we really can't do that because it's a multivariable function. So in fact, what we have to say is that E is equal to minus the partial derivative of V with respect to X in the I-hat direction, minus the partial derivative of V with respect to Y in the J-hat direction, minus the partial derivative of V with respect to Z in the K-hat direction. Okay? So that actually is how you get the electric field from the potential function. It involves taking the derivative with respect to the three variables and then putting the components properly so you get a vector. And now you can begin to see the utility that you might or might not win. The electric field is a pain in the butt to calculate directly sometimes because you have the 1 over r squared and you have the vector piece in the integral or whatever. Here, you might be able to get a potential function fairly simply because it's a simpler thing to calculate, but once you've got it, if your job is to get the field, you then have to actually take derivatives of it with respect to the various variables and then throw them together to create the actual vector for the electric field. So, clearly, sometimes that might be very tedious as well. Now, although this looks very impressive, it's a bit too straightforward. You can look at it and actually figure out what it says if you know what a partial derivative is. So we need to fix that. And what we're going to do is we are going to say that the electric field is minus some upside down triangle with an arrow over it of V. Okay? And this is your... Sorry, I get so touched. I'm choked up. This is your first vector operator. It's a big one. Cherish it forever. Okay. This is a vector operator, which we call del. Del. As in 1L, not like the computer company. Okay. Having said that, when you are actually taking the vector operator del and you are operating on a scalar quantity or a scalar field, if you want to sound really cool, okay, a field just being a mapping of the scalar quantity to all points in space, right? So, then you would call this the gradient, or you might call this, you might see this written as minus the grad of V. So this is quantity. When you operate with del, del is a vector actually, but it's a strange vector because it's not like any vector you've seen. It's a vector operator. We define it as the partial derivative with respect to x in the i-hat direction. And you go, wait a minute, you left something out here. No, that's what I mean by it's a vector operator. I now have to take this operator and act on some scalar field, and that is what I'm taking the derivative of. So this plus the derivative with respect to y in the j-hat direction plus the derivative with respect to z in the k-hat direction. So that is what I mean when I talk about the vector operator del.
And if you take this vector operator and you act on a scalar field, you call that operation, what you are determining is called the gradient. So the way to say this is that here I would be looking at the gradient of V. Okay, so imagine that we're standing on some hill somewhere, the top of the hill, and you want to look at how steep the hill is with respect to you. We would call that the gradient, right? So in a sense, we could define the direction of the maximal gradient as sort of the maximal rate of change of the potential energy of gravitational field that would roll the ball down, for example. It's going to be that piece of the direction that you would go where the hill is falling off the steepest. Okay. And that's sort of what we're doing here, except we're on an energy space. All right, and where the electric field is going to be in the direction of the greatest rate of change of the potential function. And since it's something that's changing with distance, we call it a gradient, basically. So the word may sound like it's pulled out of thin air. It actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Any questions about that? Okay. I'm going to give this one try. It may not work, but we'll see what happens. I didn't take time to come and debug it, unfortunately. Yeah, you might need them. Hey, it actually worked. Okay, so now you should be able to not have the right thing here. And I don't. God, that's an idiot. Okay. That's annoying. I don't want to do this. Okay. So give me a moment because I have to now write down the answers. Thank you.
Sorry, I had this all written down on a slide, which I forgot to grab in my office, so I just have to do this. Okay, so let me show you the problem first, and then we'll come back and vote with the PRS. All right, so imagine that I have two spheres, conducting spheres, connected by a conducting wire. Okay? And I take a pile of charge, and I deposit it on one of the spheres, it doesn't matter which one. Okay? And that charge, because it's unconductive, will distribute itself in the system. So my question to you is, what would be the charge ratio between spheres? This is meant to be an R1. Sphere 1 and sphere 2. Is the charge ratio going to be, for a given amount of charge, we'll say that a certain amount goes to radio to sphere 1, and a certain amount goes to sphere 2. Okay? So is that charge ratio going to be 50-50? Is it going to be basically go as the square? Or is it going to be proportional to the radius? So I want to give you a moment to think your way through that. So 50-50, proportional to the square, and linear proportionality. Those are your three choices, 1, 2, 3. So think about it for a minute, and I'm going to switch, and you, if you have your PRS thing, turn it on, and it should join properly. I'll come back. So turn on your PRS things and see if it's actually talking to you. Does anybody have theirs? It's not seeing you. Okay, well, we'll vote with hands. We got farther than last time. All right. What do you think? So close your eyes. All who think it's 1. All who think it's 2. All who think it's 3. Okay, so what we have were very few hands going up for 1 and very few hands going up for 3. Most of the class voted for 2. Somebody want to tell me why? Right?
Well, shouldn't the charge received be related to the surface area?
You're asking me. That's what you were thinking. Is that, okay. So what you're saying is the charge spreads itself evenly out on all the surface area where we don't worry about this little conducting wire. Okay.
Well, I think that's a very reasonable thing to think. Let's think about it a minute, though.
How much work does it take to move a bit of charge from right here to right there? They're conductors. Yeah. So because it's all a conductor, it takes no work to move it from here over here. We call it an equipotential because there's no work to go from one point to the other. Okay? So that's the one thing we actually know, is that this sphere and this sphere are at the same potential. Okay, so what does that actually mean?
If we're in a universe where we've defined the potential at infinity to be 0, then what it means is that the charge which is at this radius has a potential that is k times q1 over r1, and the potential at that point has to be the same as the charge on the other sphere, which is k times q2 over r2.
And so now what you're going to find is that the charge is proportional to the radius because they're equal potential. So, and of course I designed this deliberately to suck you up into the hole, but that's... So this is one of those weird places where I would say that your thought about it going with the area is a very reasonable thing to think, or most people would think that. But it doesn't happen that way. Because the one thing you know is that there is the same potential, and then everything follows from that.
So three is the
right answer. So three is the right answer, yeah. Okay. Now, let me ask a different question, which is very similar, I suppose. Let us suppose that we have a situation where we have a big conductor and a little conductor, and a big conductor and a little conductor, where this distance is the same in both cases, and we take a conductor to attach these to these and those, and then we take all of this and we put it across. Whoa, this is a big day. This is like an electric circuit diagram too. Your first vector operator, your first electric circuit diagram. Damn, should have brought champagne. This is good. Okay, so this symbol, that's a symbol, sort of universal symbol for an EMF, which we give a script E as opposed to the E that you're always using for that field because we're trying to make your life easy. And basically think of it as a battery or a generator or whatever, something that puts a bunch of charge. Basically separates charge, so think of it as a big battery. So now suppose I put a big battery across this conductor and that conductor, so I am literally building charge up on these things. And I keep building charge up on these things, what's eventually going to happen?
Spark.
You'll get a spark. So the question I have, you'll get a spark as you have a breakdown between these two. You'll actually have such a large electric field between these two things that you'll rip atoms apart, you'll ionize them, and you'll begin to get a flow of charge between the two. So the question that I have is, in this situation, if I have it constructed so that the big balls and the little balls are exactly the same distance apart, and I am depositing charge on the system, as you see, is that spark going to happen between the big balls or the little balls? How would you think about it?
The ratio would be a proportional to the radii, and so if the radius is on the bottom of the ratio, the one with the larger radius would have less charge on it, or like less potential.
So the ratio of what? You're doing the ratio of the charge?
Of the charge. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, so the statement is that the charge ratio goes as the radius. So you're going to have more charge on the big ball than the little ball. Is that going to... So what do you think?
I would say the big ball because there would be more charge going there. That would be a stronger electric field. It's just more charge. It'll reach the critical point faster.
Okay. All right, so... Let's think about it for a moment. So we know that the electric field for the big one goes as K times Q big over R big squared. That would be the electric field right outside that big ball. The electric field on the small one is going to be KQ small over R small squared. And so if we want to know which one will break down, let's say that EB over ES. So let's look at that ratio, see which one's actually bigger. That's going to be, the K's will cancel out, so I have Q big over R big squared over Q small over R small squared. And the Q's now go as the radii. So this is 1 over RB and 1 over R sub S. So this goes as RS over RB, which is going to be less than 1. So that means the electric field is going to be bigger for the small balls. Yeah. That's what I think. So we have, coincidentally, we happen to have a situation where we have big balls and we have little balls. So I said it okay this time. Like there was some one class, I can't remember what it was, and it was a different demo, but it involved little balls like this. And I said something, so I have a couple of little balls, and I can't remember, but I got distracted, and the whole class just started laughing and everything. So this is basically the same, distance, okay? And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to crank that and see if we can. See where the breakdown happens. Except when it doesn't. Ooh. Sorry. All right. Pretend it's concentric. Okay, so let us imagine that we have some charge. I don't want to do this. Okay, so I have a charge Q here, and if we look at some point here, which I'll call A, point here B, point here C, point here, D. Okay, so if we can imagine taking a test charge and moving it from A to B, since the potential only depends on the endpoints and the potential only depends on the distance from this charge Q, we know that the potential at point A due to Q is just KQ over R, whatever this radius is, and KQ over R is the same for B. So I know that the potential difference between points A and B is going to be zero. And because we have a conservative force, path I take doesn't matter. If I move charge from A to B, I'm going to do no work, no net work, all right? If we go from C to D, and it doesn't matter what the path is, there will be a net change in the potential, right? Because there are different radii. So we, for this particular system, we would call these circular pieces, these concentric circles, we can call these equipotential lines. They basically represent lines along which, if you move charge, it would take no work. And you will notice that they are always at right angles to the electric field. So if we have a different geometry where we take, for example, a big plus charge, put it on a plate here, and a plate that's parallel to it, and we have a negative charge, if we only worry about the region inside the plates, or we imagine the plates are very big, then we're going to have an electric field between these two plates that will basically look like this. And at some point I'll prove it to you that it's a uniform electric field going from one plate to the other. But if you look at this system, the equipotential lines are going to be lines at right angles to the electric field forever, I mean, at all points. Okay. So if you can visualize the electric field lines, you should be able to visualize the equipotential lines. Or if you can map out equipotentials, then that also gives you a feeling for the electric field lines. Because if you have the equipotential lines, the electric field line is always going to be at right angles to it, because you basically, the electric field is the gradient and the potential, it's how the potential is changing. So it's going to be at right angles to the direction of which it's constant. All right, so let's actually do a problem. Okay, so we have a Cartesian coordinate system, and what I'd like to do is to take a ring that has an axis of symmetry, which is the x-axis, and put it in the yz plane. So I'm going to take a ring and try to draw it. Not very well. So the center of that ring is meant to be the origin. It's in the yz plane, and it's supposed to have a fixed radius. So not too pretty, but I'll clean it up when I post the slides. So let's imagine that we have a point out on the x-axis, P, and we'll say that this distance, we'll just call x. And what I would like to do is to determine the potential at point P and the electric field at point P. All right? And we have to give you some sort of, let's say that the charge, we have some sort of charge of one sign or the other, which is evenly distributed. So let's just call it charge Q. Big charge Q. So if that's true, then this charge is going to go all the way around the ring, and I know that I can have a charge density, which is equal to Q, divided by the total ring circumference, which is going to be, so here's a radius, which I'll call A. A for radius. All right, so this is going to be Q divided by 2 pi A. All right, so you're taking the charge, and so the charge per unit length is going to be Q divided by 2 pi A. So what's the first thing you do if you want to calculate the potential, for example? I don't know how to do it for a ring, but I know how to do it for a point. So I hypothesize that I have one little point on this ring, I'll call it a BQ, and I just choose a position for that arbitrarily. So I will have a little dq up here, and that little dq in and of itself is going to be at some distance from point P, which I'll call R, and x, of course, is the distance from point P to the origin. What is dq? Well, dq is going to be lambda ds if s is the arc length as I go around. And I'm going to pull out the arc length because I know that to sum up the dqs, I'm basically going to be summing around the arc of this circle. So I know that it will be useful to know that dq is equal to lambda times ds. Okay? So let's consider this for a moment. Here's our ring of charge, and we have the axis, and we have a point P. A little dq over here is going to be the same distance away as a little dq over here, as a little dq over here, by construction, right? Because the ring is the same distance away from this point P, every point in the ring is. So you may be going around an angle, but the distance doesn't change. So that may mean that the dq's directionality with respect to point P differs as you go around the ring, which might make it a pain to calculate the electric field, but for the potential it's not so bad. The distance doesn't ever change. So the potential at point P is going to be equal to the integral over the whole ring of charge, K dq over R. And what is R? R is going to be equal to the square root of A squared plus X squared. So if our point P is at a fixed X, then I know what R is in terms of the radius of the circle and the distance along the axis of point P. So VP is equal to K. R is fixed, so I just pull it out. The integral of lambda ds, and lambda is a constant. So this whole thing becomes K times lambda over R times the integral of ds, which is just 2 pi A. So that's the potential at point P. And we can rewrite it in terms of the various quantities of the problem if we want. So V, the potential at point P, is equal to K times Q over R. R is going to be A squared plus X squared. And then we have the 2 pi A up above. So if I change lambda, remember lambda is Q over 2 pi A, so the 2 pi A's cancel out. This is Q over 2 pi A, so that 2 pi, the 2 pi A, if I change this to Q, cancels with the 2 pi A that's in this formula. So you end up with this as your potential at point P. Okay? Now, does this make sense? I mean, you're not done now. You want to look at this and see if it makes sense. So what you'd like to do is to go to a limiting case. Is there a limiting case where you know an answer here? What do you think? A goes to zero, it becomes a point charge. So if A goes to zero, KQ over X, and that would be the
potential of a point charge. Or if x goes to infinity, you basically get the same thing. So, yeah, so that's good. Now, if you want to take the find the electric field, at point P is equal to minus grad V, or the gradient of V. Its direction is going to be along x by symmetry because I have the same charge on this whole ring. So a piece over here and a piece over here are basically, the one up here is going to have a field like this. The one down here is going to have a field like that. And the transverse components are going to cancel by the symmetry of the problem. So I know the electric field is just going to be along x. So it turns out that although the gradient of V is potentially a nasty thing, in this case it only means I have to take the derivative with respect to x. So the derivative with respect to x of k times q over a squared plus x squared, square root of that. So that ends up being k times qx over a squared plus x squared to the 3/2 in the x hat direction. And in this case, if you let x get very large, basically a becomes irrelevant and you end up with kq over x squared, which is the field of the point charge. So at that point, you should be happy that you got the right answer. Okay? Any questions? All right. Want your homeworks up here if you've got them. And have a good weekend.